Access approved.
Froggy, pick up the box.
Froggy picks up a box.
Oh, this is so exciting.
Oh my God, it worked.
Damn, Haley.
That was Stephanie as Haley giving Froggy, when he's unhallowed, a direct command. It's basically confirming that she is indeed untethered because he does pick up that damn box. Hey, everyone. Star Master Jeff here, and welcome back to the Star Master Log. I wanted to open today with that little clip from episode 23 entitled Pick Up the Box, because to me it feels like a really pivotal moment in the podcast and the story of these characters. Haley has been encountering these alien forks multiple times throughout her career, whether they were ones that were found in a relic site or produced by the Void cultists. And now she's in a position to actually interact with Unhallowed as a confirmed untethered herself, whether she's in the Void cult or not. And it turns out it doesn't matter if she's a member of that cult, because simply being a card-carrying untethered means, apparently, that she can command Unhallowed around. She was a bit too excited about that. I thought it would be a bit more of a dramatic reveal. But as you already heard in episode 22, when she struck upon this idea for the first time, she's very excited to be able to control other people around her. And I think that's probably a little bit of Haley with one Y coming out. So anyway, this is the Star Master Log for episode 23, Pick Up the Box. If you haven't heard that main episode yet, I just spoiled the hell out of it for you, but go ahead and listen to that episode before you listen to this Star Master Log. If you're into GMing, world building, or just curious about how the story takes shape behind the screen, this episode is for you. Two things I want to get into today: how Haley's ability actually works, and what it looks like when you see Unhallowed up close for the first time, especially when it's someone you know, Froggy. So, Untethered has been in the world since episodes 11 and 12. I introduced the word, I gave it weight, I let it sit. Untethered, Unhallowed, Void Cultists, all this came together on Scrapjacks. The cult uses it. The crew has heard of it. It's been sitting in the background, and they've been bringing it up again and again, wondering what it means. And now they're starting to find out a bit more. And of course, they knew back on Scrapjacks the overview of it. Untethered is what you kind of want to be, and Unhallowed is kind of like a slave. But because the cultists' plan was stopped at Scrapjacks, we never truly get the full picture. But here on Sibylline, they fly in and they immediately attack the people at the auction, and we get our first batch of Unhallowed. So what exactly does Untethered Unhallowed mean? Well, obviously part of it is that untethered individuals can direct Unhallowed individuals. That's been the lore since day one. It's just never come up before, and I'm really happy that now we get to explore that. That's how I like to build, actually. I like to establish the parameters of something in sweeping strokes with a couple extra details in before the players actually need them, and then let the normal emergent play of OSR surface those details and bring them into the forefront. I don't want to give a spotlight to these little pieces of lore until they actually become relevant. So the advantage to that is that times like this, when the moment naturally arises, it feels a lot more organic rather than delivered or forced. I hate to run games completely on rails. The piece that wasn't established yet was the limits of what Untethered Unhallowed could mean and how an untethered person may direct an unhallowed person. But before I get into that, there are two terms the cult uses that are easy to conflate. Unhallowed, untethered. Un this, un that. They are not the same thing, not even close. So Unhallowed is what happens when a Void cultist created fork activates on someone and takes hold. The person is still there, functionally. They can move, carry out tasks, respond to orders, but there's no one home in any meaningful sense. They're maybe not brain dead, because we do see Froggy crying, but they are unable to control their own bodies. It's a labor state. The cult doesn't see this as a loss. This is very beneficial for them. These people are resources. Untethered is rarer. It's what happens when void contact doesn't suppress you, but changes you. Direct contact with the void through these forks doesn't turn you into a mindless automaton. Instead, it sort of gives you a seal of approval and threads you in to the void, so that now you can give direct orders to the Unhallowed, and you yourself are sort of protected from being turned into an Unhallowed because something there didn't click, and you are able to keep your consciousness while manipulating the void. Something in you connects to it, and you come back different. So the cults, they are actively looking for untethered people. They want to activate the fork and see what comes of it. Most people are going to be unhallowed, overwhelming majority. A lot of people, when they are introduced to the void, go kind of crazy. They join the cult. Bing, bang, boom. They're working towards the ascension, whatever that means. Some people, maybe if they're more divorced from the cult and didn't have any prior experience with them or don't have them around to influence them, like Haley, they run into these forks, they become untethered, and then they're simply lost and adrift with this weird power surging through them that they don't necessarily even know they have, but they can always feel the void calling out to them. So the cult is looking for these untethered, like Haley, and the untethered are the ones that the cult believe are ready for what the cult is actually working towards, the ascension. Haley has had 3 void contacts now, which is quite a bit, and by the cult's logic, that makes her untethered. And in this episode, we start to understand a little bit more about what that means. As they are approaching Exosite 34B for the second time, after just nearly escaping it previously, they hear Rin Cade of Nexus Trading give an order to an Unhallowed. And they sort of sit with that for a second. And once the combat has died down, Haley wonders if she can do that too. Now that's an interesting question. She's worked that out through observation, not just here, but also wondering in the previous episode about the connection between Untethered and Unhallowed. Stephanie's been ahead of the game on this one for quite a while, so it was very cool to like see her actually be able to act on this. I didn't have to like point her at that. I just had to have the lore available and make things consistent, and she made the connections, solved that puzzle, and dove into it when she saw the opportunity. She saw what Rinke did. She knows what previous pieces of the lore have pointed her towards. And my job was just to confirm what she already figured out. So she tries it. She tells Froggy to pick up the box. He picks up the box. She says, "This is very exciting." And it was. Then she tries to test the limits of Untethered to Unhallowed, which this is where things got a little fuzzy for me. She says, "Froggy, stop being unhallowed." I had to decide that in the moment. Could you order someone out of being unhallowed? The void energy is what has changed them and made them into sort of a brainless automaton. Can an untethered person essentially release them from that state? I decided no. If there is a way to reverse being unhallowed, it is not a simple command. So she tries again, and of course nothing happens. All of that comes from emergent gameplay. The ability was always there in the lore, but nobody has ever asked about the ceiling of what that power could do, and the first time Stephanie goes to explore it, she immediately starts testing its limits. So now we know an untethered person can direct an unhallowed person, but can't directly free them. Emergent play at its finest. What I do differently, knowing now that players are going to test the limits of new concepts like this as early as possible, is I would have explored those concepts a bit more fully beforehand and established the two terms earlier and more clearly so that when this moment did land, we would already have a bit more of an inkling about which way it would go, and them testing the limits would kind of be a foregone conclusion in some ways, but would still allow them to figure out exactly what the bounds of these powers are. As it stands, the distinction between unhallowed and untethered has been hinted at, but never fully laid out. And doling it out piecemeal like this, I think, has been a very good way to drip feed information. And this episode was a great reveal on how those two concepts actually clash together. We set it up beforehand so that the moments in this episode can land. This episode makes it matter. And some of that weight did get lost a bit because the vocabulary wasn't yet firmly in place. And I should have leaned on that a bit more earlier in the story, so that everyone could understand the place of an unhallowed and the place of an untethered, and not just the void cult, but in the lore of the fork and the aliens before this moment came about. But all in all, I think it was a pretty good reveal. So let's talk unhallowed, because up until this episode, the word unhallowed has just been an abstraction. It's a word. That's something the cult does to people And we know in Scrapjacks that it is going to be a bad thing because they're like, oh, they're no longer people. They're just husks. Oh, you're going to be untethered. You rock. So we kind of get their idea of untethered and unhallowed without really knowing what's going to happen to these people if the plan on Scrapjacks actually comes to fruition. So this is our first time actually seeing the unhallowed in action. So Froggy has been unhallowed since the end of episode 21, when the Void Cultist ship swoops into the landing pad and runs the fork on everyone that's there after the auction. We see in this episode he has a blank face, no eye contact, no speech, no better than a machine taking orders. He's moving through the room doing whatever he's pointed at. And that's sort of been in the background happening while the crew was figuring out how to escape their ship and what to do next. Rin Cade of Nexus Trading has a whole complex full of these people that used to be at the auction and are now unhallowed. They are doing labor, moving boxes, carrying tech. They work. They don't complain. They don't ask questions. For someone like Rin, this is a logistical solution, not really a moral quandary. There's something to be said here for capitalism, corporatism, and the way that untethered people in power treat unhallowed, the workers, the people who actually get the work done. If they could undemocratize work and have a pure dictatorship of machines working underneath them that would just work tirelessly and do whatever they said, that is exactly what a corporation would do. And that's what we see Rin Cade doing here. She didn't win the Exocyte. She wants the Exocyte. She is somehow in league with the Void Cultists. This unhallowed, untethered power is something that has been bestowed upon her, and she seizes the opportunity. What's different, obviously, with the crew is that they know Froggy. They know Vera. They may not like everyone else at the auction and sometimes not even like Froggy, but you can't simply leave someone like this to that fate. The interesting thing is when they do catch up with Froggy, they find him and there are tears streaming down his face. So I want to be careful about what I'm actually claiming here because it's worth being kind of specific. The tears could mean Froggy is still conscious somewhere inside the unhallowed state, watching what's happening to him, unable to do anything about it. And that's the reading that makes it the most horrifying. But the tears could also just be a physical response to Rin Cade kicking the crap out of him after he tripped and dropped the box. A random pain signal the body produces automatically and he starts to cry. Is Froggy still alive in there? That is the question that we need to answer and will answer in the next episode. But the image to sit with is that Froggy has tears on his cheeks, carrying a box, listening to Rin Cade, being kicked when he messes up because being unhallowed doesn't stop you from being clumsy. Something else to probably note is that Rin Cade does not appear to be a true believer. Like, she's not really in the Void Cult, is she? She's not dressed like them. She doesn't talk like them. She works for Nexus Trading. The unhallowed just seem like a resource to her. The tears are not her problem. It doesn't matter if someone is conscious in there. In fact, she may even derive some pleasure if Froggy truly is still in there somewhere, in ordering him around and kicking him. It is the ultimate fascist wet dream. The labor gets done either way, and the lesser people just have to listen to orders. You know what? I'm going to say it. I'm happy those two Void Cultists were killed this episode, and I hope next episode a lot more die too. So you'll have to tune in to find out. Hey guys, real quick. If you're enjoying the show and you want to stay 2 weeks ahead of the story, the Patreon is how you do it. $5 a month gets you every episode, every Star Master log, and every SWN rules breakdown with Brian, all before they hit the public feed. The Star Master logs especially. That's where I get into what was actually planned versus what happened in the episodes, the scenes I improvised on the spot, and what the players did that I didn't see coming. It's a behind-the-screen version of everything you are hearing right now, and if that sounds like your sort of thing, head on over to patreon.com/darkstaradventurecast, because the next episode is already out. So there is that moment back in episode 21 where Strake shows back up, and the crew's reaction says everything about that, because they had completely forgotten about him. They had stopped thinking about him. He went off screen sometime back on Wafisa after they killed his clone, and they thought maybe he was a clone or a double or had a twin brother. And then somewhere in the back of their minds, he became a solved problem and they outran him and went from place to place, Scrapjacks to Sibylan. And that was it. Victor Strake, guy with the stupid haircut. Boom. We beat that mini boss. Moving on. Next boss. But oh no, dear listener, he was not a solved problem. Because off screen, he's been tracking them, adjusting his plan, gathering information. He found out who Haley with two Ys really is. Oh, now it's not just about getting back the scapegoat. It's about bringing Haley to Omnitech. She's quite valuable. But then, what's this? The exosite is open? Oh, a virtual intelligence named Dr. Voss, harnessed inside of an alien chassis. The first ever. Oh, there we go. Even more valuable than Haley. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And so when he has that chance, he takes Dr. Voss and pivots. The point I'm trying to make here is that he's not an NPC that sits there on a shelf waiting for the PCs to interact with him or until I decide the story should circle back around to him. He is as real as the characters. He exists in the universe of the Viridian Expanse, just like the characters. He doesn't pause when the players look away because factions are moving. Resources are changing hands, and the guy that the crew dismissed several episodes ago is actually still working on something, and he's coming back more dangerous than ever. The world is constantly changing with their input, but even the absence of input is still input. They're out there somewhere else. Strake is still moving and doing his plans. It's worth asking what every other piece on the board is doing while the players aren't looking. They aren't in stasis. They are actually moving and grooving with their own motives and trying to get it done. So the crew didn't lose to Strake and get locked inside the scapegoat and have Dr. Voss kidnapped because of a bad role, because I decided that's what has to happen in the story. They had a serious gap in attention. They forgot about Strake. They pushed him to the back burner. They flaunted Dr. Voss. They didn't sweep their ship or in any way tried to secure it. And so that gap in attention was paid for. The world filled in that gap, and we see what happens when you don't pay attention. And it makes something very emergent, and that's what I mean by a shared story. The players define the pace and the shape of the story, what they are chasing, what they ignore, their motivations, where they spend their time, but never forget that the world has its own momentum. And when those two things collide, conflict is earned. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a lot stronger than just opening an episode and saying, hey, this town is in trouble. You have a moral responsibility to help them and just hope they play along. It's much stronger for me to say, hey, this guy's been working behind the scenes for the last 10 episodes, and now he's back, baby, and he's taking Dr. Voss with him. You got outplayed. What are you going to do about it? And to be clear, nobody manufactured that Strake moment. It just came about by natural processes. And it landed because it was real. The players felt the weight of it because somewhere, underneath all of the layers, they knew they should have dealt with him sooner. And they didn't. And now, the hens have come home to roost. So speaking of the crew and the mistakes they've made, I would like to actually take a moment to talk about who these characters actually are. And just give a brief minute to each one, because the crew has been in motion long enough now, over 23 episodes, that I think it's worth just taking a simple step back and just placing them into the broader narrative with a bit of their history. So Captain Thorne, 39 years old, he's the oldest on the crew. He was born on Zephyrus 3, where his family ran Drax's goods for 5 generations. His mother framed him for a smuggling operation she was running, and he served 10 years of a 12-year sentence before Omnitech bought out the remainder of his contract. He plays Loki Pawn, he's a songwriter, and although he acted as a brief CEO for Drax's Goods, he's probably not getting back there anytime soon. Felix, 36, born on New Lucerne, a resource-poor world. He learned to fix things by pulling electronics out of a dump site at age 6. He changed his face, his voice, and his name after a heist that went wrong in a bid to regain his brother Petey from Viridine Industries. His prosthetic leg was badly installed by a military surgeon, and it causes him chronic pain. and his brother Petey's consciousness is trapped in an Omnitech server being run through nightmare simulations to train AI as part of Project Red Wing, which is also a project that Thorne was almost adopted into and barely escaped by the skin of his teeth. Haley is, surprisingly, the third youngest at 27. Born on V-Grid, a desert world in the Thraxis system, she trained herself in secret from childhood. Week-long survival runs with only kitchen knives, improvised workout equipment built in behind the house. Her parents were very much against her joining the military, but they never really noticed her constant training as a problem until she joined the military, and she graduated near the top of the Omnitech assassination program. She lost the top spot to a rival later on because she went against orders during a final exam and decided to use her fists instead of her cunning, but eventually went on to captain a squad in several theaters at a very young age. Robert, although he looks like he's the oldest, is actually the youngest in the crew, and that's thanks to him being a clone. Robert is a little itty-bitty 6 years old, though he appears to be in his low 30s. He believes himself to be just shy of 50. He's a clone, RR7, grown in a lab as part of a program that has actually long since been scrapped, partly because of the performance of him and his squad. Everything before his real first mission is actually implanted memories. His hobbies, mannerisms, sense of humor, the story about getting scammed on his bionic eyes, all of that is generated, not even real memories, just random BS generated and shoved into his head. And then all of the combinations of those things came together to produce the weirdo we know and love, Robert Ross. It literally produced him. Of course, he thinks he's the original. But is he, though? And that's the crew. If you want to actually know more about them, we do have 4 focus episodes out. One for Thorne, Felix, Haley, and Robert. And each focus episode dives into their backstory and tells you in depth a lot more about a certain moment, mostly pivotal, in their lives. Go back and check those focus episodes out. They are always worth a re-listen. And now we're moving on to the Star Master Rec, where I recommend a book, movie, or other piece of media that ties into this week's episode in some meaningful way. And this week's Star Master Rec is Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie. A book I read last year, absolutely loved, and I cannot recommend it any more highly, which is something I say, I think, on every rec, but I do really, really love it. It came out in 2013 and won basically every major award that year. I give it 4 of 5 stars. So the reason it's this week's pick is the ancillaries themselves. If you've already read the book, you already know exactly where I'm going with this, but in non-spoilery terms, in Ancillary Justice, the ancillaries are human bodies whose consciousness has been suppressed, so they can be used as extensions of a controlling AI. They walk, they carry out orders, they function, but they don't have an inner life that matters to the system that's actually using them. They're people who have been turned into tools. And of course, that immediately makes us think about Froggy carrying boxes with Rin Cade, controlling him, kicking him. That's the picture I have in my head when I remember Ancillary Justice. And now the two are very linked for me. And when I was actually in that scene with the crew and we were recording, I couldn't stop thinking about this book. I was like, I hadn't made that connection before, but this is very much like Ancillary Justice. And it's definitely one of those times where you read enough, you watch enough, and eventually those other pieces of media start to creep into your own narrative. And this is one of the best. What stayed with me after reading it last October is that Leckie makes you feel the loss from the inside, which is harder than it sounds. The main character is an ancillary, which means you spend the whole novel inside the perspective of someone who doesn't have full access to their own human experience. You feel the edges of what's been taken rather than the thing itself. Anyway, I don't want to spoil anything. You should definitely go read it. I finished it in 2 sittings. It's not a very long book, and it will sit with you for the rest of your life. It is definitely worth your time. On the next episode of the Dark Star Adventure Cast, Felix's peepholes are open. He cut 3 holes in a wall he sealed using a goo cake. Oh my god, what is this game? And the crew has lined up to look through. Rin Cade is somewhere beyond that wall, and so are several unhallowed. Froggy is sitting in a corner with a thumbs up and a cat, following the last few orders he was given. The crew came into this exosite to take back their people with no plan beyond getting in and figuring it out. which has worked for them before, but already they're starting to feel like they're in over their head. So next episode, they go in the rest of the way, full dive, and Rincade is waiting for them. Well, that's it for my time tonight. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next one. If you want to hear every episode before the public feed, the Patreon is how you do it. $5 a month gets you everything 2 weeks early. The main episodes, the Star Master logs, and even the SWN rules breakdown that Brian records to go with each and every episode. Head on over to patreon.com/darkstaradventurecast, because the next episode is already out.